This is a HeadGum Original.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
I mean, I understand from your point of view, there is one thing to not like about Tom Hanks. For all the rest of us, there is literally nothing to not like about Tom Hanks. That's part of what's charming.
I'm talking to filmmaker Rian Johnson, writer-director of Knives Out, Looper, and Star Wars Episode VIII, The Last Jedi. If you've seen any of Rian's movies, you know that he's known for writing stories that often go in unexpected directions, twisting and turning in ways that are surprising and often thought-provoking. Hopefully this episode is a little bit like that.
Well, thank you so much for doing this, Rian.
No, I'm just happy to talk. I'm not sure, what element of this could I possibly weigh in on?
There's several different elements, actually.
What you're about to hear is a complicated story, but I promise you, all of it is true. I'm just going to start out by listing four films and the people who wrote them. George Lucas wrote and directed Star Wars. Tom Hanks wrote and directed That Thing You Do. Rian Johnson wrote and directed The Last Jedi. And I wrote and starred in a very obscure, very low-budget feature film called Living in Missouri. I did not direct it, but I played a main character in it, a villain. And I promise you, this all leads back eventually to me in the year 2000 in the room re-auditioning for Tom Hanks, and a sentence that I very nearly said out loud, but ultimately decided not to.
This is Dead Eyes, a podcast about one actor's quest to find out why Tom Hanks fired him from a small role in the 2001 HBO miniseries Band of Brothers.
Buckle up. This will all make sense by the end of the episode.
Hmm? So you introduce yourself.
Sure. I'm Jackie Jennings. I'm a host for the Sci-Fi Channel and also formerly a performer at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater. It makes it sound like I was fired. I wasn't.
Yeah, the door's not closed. You can do shows there. You've closed it.
But I walked out and closed it behind me.
But in any case, we know each other.
And, we do.
I'm very excited to talk to you about something that it's not a secret, but it's not something that I've ever talked to you about. And I think it's a fun thing that happened.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very strange, which is that in the 90s, when George Lucas announced that he was going to make more Star Wars movies, they released these special editions, and then there was a big announcement that he's going to make a new trilogy of Star Wars prequels. And I was in England at the time going to drama school, and I was in the first graduating class of a school that Paul McCartney opened called the Liverpool Institute for Performing Arts. Mm-hmm. And one of the tasks for this class was that you had to create a website. You had to learn how to create a website. And you didn't have to do just like an actor website for the assignment of the class. It was just about how to learn how to do it. And for fun, I decided to create a website that was made up entirely of rumors about the Star Wars prequels.
Okay. can I ask, Connor, did other people, by and large, did they make actor webs, like headshot type websites for themselves?
I mean, I think I did one, but it was so easy. Okay. You just put your picture
you
up and
second.
Then it's like, yeah, none of us had like like clips or, you know, it was before
sure.
You had video online. So that was pretty easy.
Sorry, but here's my resume. Yeah.
Yeah. So I was doing it for fun. I created this website and it was all fake rumors. It was just a joke website. And this was when this idea felt more fun. And I was trolling a little bit, but it wasn't. I thought it was just very silly, and I thought it was very obviously not true. My rumors were so dumb. There was a line of Star Wars Tamagotchis called Star Wars Gigapets. These were digital pet little toys on a keychain that you had to click buttons to feed them and play with them or they would die. And when you bought one of these, the card on the back showed pictures of the other Star Wars Gigapets that were available. R2-D2 and the Rancor from Jabba's Palace. but it also listed other Gigapets that were just regular Gigapet characters. But the card made it look like they were all also Star Wars Gigapets. This really amused me, so I decided to announce that these were the new characters Lucas had created for Star Wars, and I treated this as if it was a legitimate leak of new information about the movies. Much the same way we learned about Boba Fett or Admiral Akbar before the movies they were in were released, we were now learning about Digital Doggy and CompuKitty and Microchimp. In hindsight, none of these characters seems more ridiculous than Jar Jar Binks or Newt Gunray. This is a copy of Spin Magazine.
Wow.
And it has this little header at the top. And I've marked the page there, yeah. These aren't all my rumors. This is like a 4 or 6 page illustrated piece that Spin Magazine did about rumors about Star Wars, about the new movies. Do you see that picture of a squirrel at the bottom of the page there?
Furry creature. I just saw that on the site. Trinkies.
Yeah. I said the first movie was going to be about Anakin's 10th birthday. And it was largely going to focus on the Trinkies, which were an adorable squirrel-like race of creatures who at first, they disrupt his birthday party, but then by the end of the movie, everyone becomes friends.
And a journalist saw this and said, okay, this is a legit, this could be a, I'm not going to say the name of the author, but someone thought, oh, Trinkies. The whole first movie will be about Trinkies.
Well, in fairness to the people who were writing this article, they were cultivating rumors from various websites.
Sure.
And mine were the dumbest ones on the internet. So I think mine were the ones that made the feature fun.
Yeah, the Trinkies.
This was the part that was the most thrilling to me. Up at the top, they did the titles in the Star Wars font.
Yes.
So literally half of those titles are things that I made up. And
Anakin's birthday. That sounds like an episode of an animated series.
Yeah. Well, because sometimes on my website, I would just make up like 20 titles and say, these are all being considered.
Which of these aren't yours? Trinkies Go Home is obviously yours.
That's mine.
Dark Side Energy Bolts.
That's
feels
mine.
Feels like yours.
Yeah.
The Clone Wars.
I don't think so.
Okay. Star Was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that one for a prequel, you know, because it's just past tense.
Star Was. And wait, this one, is it Star Wars with a little Luke?
Yeah.
With
there's
a
Paul
Luke.
McCartney pun there.
What
he
is
had the
it?
Song I'm... With a Little Luck, but it's with a little Luke.
Okay.
Yeah.
And they printed these as potential titles.
Yeah. Some designer took the time to craft those into the proper Empire Strikes Back style logo.
Did you have a, was it sort of like a page six, just blind items? Or did you have a character that you were like, I heard from a little mole? I don't know.
Well, that's the thing. And this is where it gets interesting.
Okay.
So I made up this website full of Star Wars prequel rumors. And it was in this era, Yahoo was the way you'd find things on the internet. And it wasn't a search engine. It was a curated list. This feels as quaint as like a card catalog or something where it's like.
It's when David Yahoo would.
Yeah. People would submit sites and then you'd get listed under the proper category because there were so few websites. So if you looked up Star Wars prequel rumors, my website was the first one to get cataloged and listed. And then it remained at the top for years until they, if you were looking up Star Wars prequel rumors, mine would come up and then a bunch of legitimate sites would come up below it. But mine would get the clicks because it was right there.
Sure.
So I decided I don't want my name on this website. I don't want it to be Connor Ratliff's Star Wars prequel rumors.
Sure.
So I created a character and I picked a name. It was just an ordinary name. I just wanted to pick an ordinary, normal sounding name.
I don't believe you.
This is the website.
Whoa.
That I created. And the character I created was named.
What?
Ryan Johnson.
That's nuts.
Yes.
Whoa.
So the website was called Ryan Johnson's Star Wars Prequel Rumors.
Yeah, this is really, really weird.
That's right. The character I created in 1998 was named Ryan Johnson. And exactly 19 years later, filmmaker Ryan Johnson would become the second person ever to both write and direct a Star Wars movie. He spells his name R-I-A-N, and my character's name was spelled R-Y-A-N, but still. It was a strange thing that kept getting stranger. When Brick came out, I was like, oh, that name is a name that I've been living with for a while. Spelled a little different.
Yeah.
You had a better spelling, a more interesting spelling.
Thank you, Mom.
I got used to your existence. But then over time, it just became this thing where, you know, I'd see Looper or Brothers Bloom or episodes of Breaking Bad and things, and your name would pop up and it became its own separate thing. It no longer was weird to me. It no longer was connected to the thing that I had done. And then when you got announced that you were going to do a Star Wars movie.
Time folding in upon itself. We are through the Matrix.
Even at this point, with the number of, you know, the uptick in Star Wars movies, that's still a very small club.
It's people who have been in space type club, yeah.
And it also, the fact that I was, Rian Johnson to me felt like I was just trying to think of a normal name, just a name that...
Some real schnook.
Well, he ended up becoming a schnook because, this is before this kind of thing became insidious. I thought it was just, at the time, I was just trying to have fun. Made up this fake Star Wars rumor site, made up a fake name for it. And then I started getting hate mail.
Interesting.
And people would email me telling me how much they hated me, calling me a lot of names, mostly homophobic slurs, and occasionally telling me that I should kill myself. It's my first real exposure to what we are now so familiar with, the kind of toxic bullying that I hadn't really experienced prior to that. These people were so angry and so hostile to a total stranger, and it was all about Star Wars. They were angry about Star Wars, this thing that's supposed to be fun. I became fascinated by this because what I was sensing was that there was a kind of Star Wars fan who had grown up and they still identified as a Star Wars fan, but they were no longer happy people. They hated themselves, they hated their lives, they no longer had any capacity for joy, and yet they still had this thing that they were attached to. They didn't know what to do with their lives, and they didn't know what to do with their anger. I was interested in the idea of a guy who was no longer happy, but who's still joylessly obsessed with the same thing that had made him happy as a kid. So I wrote a screenplay for me to act in. And my character was named Rian Johnson, and he was angry all the time, and humorless, and unhappy with what his life had turned out to be as a guy in his mid-20s. And he was a Star Wars fan with a Star Wars website. It's strange that you ended up having this like relationship with or lack of with like a small, that same small fraction of that fan base, which I've found in my experience was always like, I've seen in interviews lately when people have asked you this and you're talking about how really is always a small, but vocal.
Yeah.
It's sort of like that thing where it's like reviews of electronics that you want to buy. And you look online and you want to buy a TV, you can't find any TV that doesn't have people furious about this TV.
At least two things on there that are, yeah, deep, yeah. Deeply angry rants.
Because nobody yeah. buys a TV and then goes and writes a positive review that, oh, my TV works. Everything I watch looks fine. And so that is the nature of like complaining, that it is like the people who are mad about something are, you know, looking to express it anyway.
Right.
And the people who like stuff are just getting on with their life. They're having a good time somewhere.
Well, and then there's kind of like the Twitter news cycle thing where, and I think we're all kind of getting wise to this a little bit, but where, you know, whatever, let's disconnect it from Star Wars. Let's say like you have 8 people on Twitter are, you know, say like, oh, those shoes that the celebrity is wearing are ugly. Or no, like 2 people on Twitter say that and like 1 person retweets it. And then there are 8 headlines the next day. Twitter is in an uproar about so-and-so's shoes. It's that kind of amplification process. And I should make it very clear that I'm not, and I always make this clear when I say it in interviews. And then when when angry YouTube ranters quote me, they always leave this bit out, but I'll say it for everyone else. I'm not talking about people who don't like the movie. When we talk about this group, I've had over the past 2 years so many positive, healthy interactions with people who both like and don't like The Last Jedi. What we're referring to here is just people who are online primarily, in many cases, to troll and to hurl abuse at people who were involved with the movie or who like the movie. We're talking about real hardcore internet trolls here, not people who just, anyone who doesn't like the film. So I always make that distinction.
Right. And I, of course, will cut that part out of
this
podcast.
I know you will.
Because it's not sensational enough.
I get it.
No, I'm always like that too, in that I was worried about doing this podcast that it was going to be perceived, and I want to go out of my way to make sure that this, me doing this, is not like an anti-Tom Hanks podcast.
Right.
Even in my telling of the story of what happened, it's still like...
Even just, I was thinking about this recently, if I had just gotten a phone call that day saying, you're out, that wouldn't have been a very interesting experience. I got to have the experience of going in the room and meeting him.
Right,
you know, like,
right.
He gave me a shot, you know?
Well, and it's also something that resonated with me because I have spent my career on the other side of that. And it's so hard because you're, on one hand, it is very much a professional process, and you can't cast everybody, and there are situations where you have to do what you think is right for the movie. At the same time, it's impossible to not be aware that you're breaking hearts on a daily basis in the casting process. I always try and make an effort through the casting process to everyone who comes in to try and give them, make sure they're having a good experience out of it as well. You know, I feel like I can, if someone walks in the room, I'm there to work with that person on that scene, and let's have a good experience doing this together. And then whether or not it ends up happening in terms of the role, that's a whole separate thing. But I always want to try and make a connection with an actor when they come in the room.
Have you ever had to fire an actor?
Yes, I have. Not because of bad behavior, but yeah, I have been in that situation before, and it was... And it's, first of all, it was, you know, not their fault. It was entirely my fault. It was entirely on me for casting the wrong person in the role to begin with. And I felt absolutely horrible that I had to do it. It was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do.
It's funny to me at this point, I think at this point it would be harder for me to do something and then like get cut out of the movie than it would to not get the role. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like there's that thing of, I no longer have hope when I go into auditions. I don't mean that as like that sounds dark.
No, I get what you mean. I think that's healthy, actually.
which only gets bad when things really go dry, you know?
Yeah, and building up those mental firewalls, I think, is incredibly healthy, you know, no matter what you do in life, I think. Because you can't, the thing is, it's like you can't control what actually happens. What you can control is how you process it and tell it back to yourself, almost the storytelling element of how you're going to look at it in your own head. That's the only thing you have control over. And so if you can do that in such a way where you don't feel like crawling into a hole and dying for the rest of the week, then that's what you should be doing. That's your job.
Have you had professional experiences personally where you have gotten your hopes too high about something and then it's gone, it's taken a bad turn?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God, yeah. I mean, well, I wrote my first movie, Brick, when I was 22 and basically spent my 20s failing to get it made. Yeah, there was one point where we had a company that was in and we were going to get like $1 million to make the movie, and we had an actor who was quite hot at the time who was going to do it, and everything. It was literally a thing where this is happening. And then, you know, I woke up the next morning and there was a voicemail that I forget whether the actor fell out or the company pulled out or something, and it was gone. It was just like a bubble. It popped and it was gone. And we were back to square one with it and had no leads at all.
I think that's why the Band of Brothers experience was, when I look at it in the overall arc of my life, it was like a moment where I was not strong enough to withstand that kind of disappointment. You know, it really was a thing where it was like, I need to get away from this because it's
right.
It's never going to be enough. If I'm relying on a consistent stream of success
right.
in order to be happy, that will fail me at some point. You know, even if things were to go well.
And do you feel like this experience was the point where you put that into context in your own life and decided, what am I attaching my happiness in life to? And is that something I have any control over? And if not, then I better find something else to attach my happiness to. Was this really like kind of the incident that made you kind of blink at that, or at least that element of your life?
It was such a pronounced thing because I'd been an actor in London for 2 years. And I wasn't, I was also like trying in the same time I was doing this, I was trying to make my own movie because I was trying to be proactive. I'd written this film for myself to star in and I was going to help produce it, basically get it made. So I was being very like proactive about my whole career, but I wasn't enjoying it. And the experience of getting Band of Brothers was such a high point. It felt so exactly like now it's going to be good for me from now on. Right. Like I'm going to work on real movies and real TV shows with Steven Spielberg and Tom Hanks. Like these are
right.
names I'd grown up with as these like, these were larger than life figures. And now I was going to be a small part, but you know, I envisioned that this is just the beginning.
Sure.
And then when I was suddenly out, it was embarrassing because I felt like I had screwed up and I felt like one of my favorite actors had looked at me acting and said, no, I don't, this is not good enough. And I remember thinking, well, it's not going to get easier. Mm. If I can't be good enough for this, then maybe I'm just not right for this business.
Yeah.
Have you ever crossed paths either personally or professionally with Tom Hanks?
Yeah. I've met with him before. I think I met him in passing, but then also one time we just had a general meeting. I went over to Playtone and sat down with him and just had a conversation.
My guess is that he really likes Looper and Brick.
You know, I think it was Looper that he had seen, and that's why we were sitting down and talking. And there's no disconnect between your perception of what he'd be. He was like, you know, he's incredibly different than Carrie Fisher, obviously, but the similarity is that I didn't find any kind of disconnect between my perception of what he would be like and what he was like, which is similar with Carrie. He's just a kind, thoughtful, you know, lovely guy. He's not like on all the time or anything. He's just easy to have a conversation with and just, genuinely friendly, smart dude.
Part of this whole process has been like me letting go of, I didn't read the book Status Anxiety. There's a philosophy book called that.
I don't know that one.
By Alain de Botton.
Sure.
I'm probably saying that wrong. And I didn't read the book, but I read, sounds so dumb. I read the back of the book and I was like, oh, this is a thing. It's all about like how unhealthy it is to sort of measure yourself against other people's achievements. And I read the back of the book and it cured me.
Well, who is it who had the quote that the second they touch down in LA, the back of their mind just starts chugging, how am I doing? How am I doing? How am I doing? How am I doing? I think there is something specifically about our business that that highlights that.
Do you still feel anxious or have you gotten to a place where you feel comfortable?
To any extent where I don't feel anxious, it's not because I feel like, oh, I've made it and I'm on solid ground or something. It's because I feel like you have to, you know, you have to at least get yourself to a place where you believe you've made peace with the idea that, you know, I'm in a good place right now, but every career is a narrative, you know, no career is a plateau. Everything goes up and down, up and down. And maybe I won't be, maybe it could be a month from now that everything will crash and I won't be able to get movies made anymore. And you kind of have to just make peace with that as a concept because, you know, you used to take a look at directors that you love, that you respect, who are legendary directors who, you know, very, very few of them are able to sustain a level where they're able to keep making the movies they want to make for their entire careers. So I think that's the thing that helps me in terms of the anxiety is letting go of the notion that it's really something I can control. And realizing, like we talked about earlier, you have to define your happiness based on things that you can control in your life. And that's not one of them.
Let me ask you a question about me because you've seen me perform.
Yeah.
You've seen me do improv on a comedy stage at a comedy theater.
I have.
Did you get a good look at my eyes?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I looked straight into your eyes. You know what I saw in those eyes, Connor? Life.
That's good to hear.
Okay, I know what you're thinking. You said this whole story was going to tie back into Band of Brothers somehow. Well, when we return in a moment, I'm going to tell you about Holmes Osborne. We'll be right back.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Oh, boy.
Hi there, Holmes.
Oh, boy.
Oh, boy.
How you doing, Connor?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you?
I'm good. I got a break. I went fishing, caught a whole gob of fish, and I'm good. Do you know where Lake Pomme de Terre is?
I've heard of it, but I couldn't find it on a map unless there was a small map with just one lake. So I've written this movie, and it's about two best friends, and one of them is married and one of them is single, and my friend Sean Peterson, who is going to direct the movie, tells me there's an actor we might be able to get to be in the movie. His name is Holmes Osborne, and he lives in Kansas City, Missouri, when he's not out in L.A. working in film and television. Holmes is a real professional film actor. I mean, we were just kids. We didn't know what we were doing, but he was the real deal. And he had had supporting roles in a handful of our favorite recent movies that had come out over the previous couple of years, including, and this is key, the dad in That Thing You Do, written and directed by Tom Hanks.
Are you recording?
Yeah. I had written three scenes for you. We wanted to do some improvisation with you on camera. And so we really wrote the scenes as more like a roadmap, more like these are the beats we want to hit.
Right.
And then we wanted to see what you would come up with. And I remember it was so fun improvising with you.
It was fun, wasn't it? Well, what I like about that, of course, is that I was having some success, but nobody was writing a role for me.
And when you're at a certain level, you sort of feel like anybody who's higher up can help, even though everybody's trying to, you know, it's the whole industry is people who are, even people at the top are panicking because they're afraid that it's going to go away.
The insecurity never goes away as an actor.
And neither does the delusion that someone higher up was going to help.
Yeah.
And you were, it was incredibly helpful to us artistically and creatively to have you in the movie. I showed it to someone recently for another thing, and they said, Donnie Darko's dad is in the movie.
Yeah, yes. That's what it became eventually, Donnie Darko's dad. That's right.
But we really thought like, well, now it's a real movie because we have a real actor who's in it with us.
Yeah.
Uncle Roy?
Hello.
It's Ryan.
Hey, Ryan, come on down. Let me tell you what I did this morning. I was rummaging around here in the basement. I go on eBay. I scan the shot of this thing in to eBay. I go on in. An hour and a half later, I have sold this pup for $250. It's great. I love this internet thing. Yeah. You know, if you hadn't introduced me to this, I don't know what I'd be doing. I'd sit down here playing with myself.
You know, I'll fast forward to my break in Hollywood because I had worked 3 years in Shakespeare with Tom Hanks at the Great Lakes Shakespeare Festival when he was an apprentice. I had kept up with him where the other theater actors probably should have, because I wrote him a note when I saw he had written and was going to direct That Thing You Do, which meant nothing to me. But I dropped him a note and said, you know, you had mentioned at one time, if you got your own project, I was top of the list. And I just gave him a reminder that we didn't have email. I wrote him a letter. And with 3 days later, he wrote me back and said, "You'll be Mr. Patterson. I'll be Mr. White." But one of the reasons I felt like I wanted to improvise in your film was that I got on the set in That Thing You Do. I was projecting too much. I was doing too much facially. And of course, Tom at that point was no longer an apprentice in Equity. He had already done some big films. He saw, Connor, that I was not film acting.
You were doing stage acting.
I was stage acting. And he came over when we were ready to shoot my first scene. We'd rehearsed it. He saw what I did with his words. And a guy walked by with a prop ad for Telemart, which I wasn't accustomed to.
Just a quick note. Telemart that Holmes is referring to here, in the movie That Thing You Do, is the big Walmart-style competitor to his character's small-town, locally-owned electric appliance store. Not to be confused with Telemart, the popular e-commerce site based in Pakistan.
That newspaper there. And he pulled the ad over for Telemart. He took his script. He had his script in his hand, and he threw it off set. And he said, "I wrote it. I can get rid of it. We don't need that anymore." And he said, let's see what old Telemart's up to." Oh, Shoeshine Kid. Do you sell Shoeshine Kids at your appliance store? What? Open Sunday, 10 to 6. Let's see. You go to church, don't you, Mr. Patterson? What do you think about being open on Sunday, 10 to 6? That'd be bad. Yeah, that's right. That'd be bad. That's it. Okay, you take the ad. You go look at it, and we're going to shoot the scene. And you just wing it, do what comes to your head based on the ad compared to your store. But there's one line I want you to make sure you do get in. "I don't believe I want to live in a country where a man has to work on Sunday to support his family." We shot the scene. I improvise it. A shoeshine kid. What is it? I kind of was doing what he told me to do, you know, but loosely.
Yeah.
And I forgot to say, "I don't believe I want to live in a country." I wasn't accustomed to improvising. I'd fiddled with it in acting classes and stuff, but I wasn't in Second City or anything. And he said, all right, "Holmes, make sure," my dad always said that, "make sure you get that line in, okay?" We got the scene. He shot it, you know, 2 or 3 times. And he said, "Let's move on. I like it." So that was the beginning of my idea that I could improv. And I did, all my scenes were improvised, pretty much.
It's so interesting to me to hear you describe that, you know, because it feels like such a precarious thing. You're on That Thing You Do. You are not an experienced film actor at that point. Did you have a realization before that experience that you were doing it too big, or did you just realize it when he started? Was it a thing that you realized in hindsight?
I really realized it when Tom called me on it, because he came over and whispered in my ear, Holmes, less is more. Less is more."
It's weird to realize now that, like, you basically got a crash course when you were doing That Thing You Do, which was Tom just telling you, like, less is more.
That's right.
And why don't we loosen this up? And then it's a few years later, I'm sitting in a basement in Kansas City, and I'm patterning I'm taking my level from you.
Which I got because of what he told me.
That's 2 degrees of film acting. It's like being passed on from one actor to another and then to another. That's an interesting connection that I wouldn't have occurred to me.
Isn't that interesting?
So I met you, and we filmed our scenes for Living in Missouri over Thanksgiving weekend, November 99.
I think Sean's mom fixed me soup.
Yes. Yeah. I know there was cooking in the house that day.
Yeah. I was sick.
I think it was a few months later that I booked the role in Band of Brothers.
Oh, I remember that now that you say that. Sean told me that.
Yeah, and I remember being very excited because it was sort of like one thing after another. I did a whole bunch of auditions for it, and I was not thinking it was going to go anywhere. Not the show, me in it. I didn't think I was going to get anything in it.
I remember this now, Connor. I had completely forgotten, but I forget a lot of things. Yep.
And I remember thinking, oh, this will be great because if there's any small talk, on the set, you know, which is not a thing that, you know, I was thinking, oh, I'll be so nervous to work on this thing. I thought I could always drop your name like that. I knew I had a thing that I could talk to him about.
Absolutely.
And I was thinking, oh, that'll be nice because I'll be able to say like, hey, I just made this little movie and Holmes did a part in it.
Sure.
They cut my hair and I got my costume fitting and everything. And it all felt very, it was bigger than anything I'd been a part of. Just even going around the area where they were filming.
I understand. Big deal. Yep.
It felt so huge, especially because...
Okay, so this is the part where I tell Holmes the entire Band of Brothers firing story. If you've listened this far, I assume you've heard me tell this story before. I tell it in the first episode. I've probably told some version of it in every episode since. I apologize. But I know that Holmes was aware of all this back when it happened, because at the time, he sent me a really kind postcard just telling me to hang in there. It really meant a lot to me. But that was a long time ago, and I think this may have been the first time that he heard the story directly from me. He thinks you have dead eyes.
He thinks what?
That you have dead eyes.
Oh, no.
You know, you go through a lot of thoughts when you're freaking out like that.
Of course.
What do I do? What do I do? How can I, you know, because you're in survival mode.
Oh,
gosh. You're in panic mode.
And worrying about something, of course, that you should have never been told about or in any way that would affect you like that would for an audition to hang on to a part that you thought you'd already gotten.
And just when you're an actor and you're worrying, you're already losing.
Yes.
And I remember thinking, because there was, you know, I went down there and I'm waiting and I go in and I did this, I meet Tom and I do the scene. And I remember thinking this in the room, should I say, hey, Holmes Osborne says hi.
That's a tough one, whether to try to relate personally or not, isn't it? In the room, especially. If you both walked out to go to the bathroom or something, yeah. But in the room, you never know what to do.
What if I was just on the razor's edge of he could go either way with it?
Yes.
And I thought, what if it makes the difference that we have a personal connection and that I just worked with you? And I thought, well, maybe he could, you know, in the ideal version of it, I thought I would say it and then he'd think, I'll call Holmes, see what he says about this kid or something. You know,
yeah,
like
right.
I had these scenarios in my mind that maybe it could help.
Right.
There was the moment where I could have done it. You know, there's that moment where you could say, hey, I just did a film with a friend of yours that you've worked with, Holmes Osborne.
Of course.
Now, it could have been something where he'd immediately say like, oh, hey, you know, that's great. It could also play like exactly what it would have been, like a desperate move by a desperate actor.
Right. Right.
It could also be the thing that feels like you're trying to use my friend. It could have made things worse.
Yeah. Yeah.
In the moment, I remember thinking, you know what? If I were to try that and it fail, I'll feel worse.
Yeah. You don't know what the reaction will be. Yeah.
There's that line in Glengarry Glen Ross. You never open your mouth until you know what the shot is. And I thought, like, this could work,
yeah,
but it probably won't.
Yeah,
I already know that if this goes the way I feel like it's going to go, I'm going to feel bad about this.
Yeah,
and I don't need a second thing to feel bad about, that I, like, made it worse.
Right, right.
And there was a period where, in the aftermath of it, where I thought, I should have said it. But that period faded. And over time, and I think this is wisdom... over time, I've realized that, oh, 100% that would have been the wrong move. It would have been a real Hail Mary pass.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm not good at those.
Hollywood operates on knowing people. I always just kind of waited for the agent to call. I didn't ever try to use, especially with my relationship with Tom Hanks, I didn't want to abuse that in any way, and I wanted to get in the Green Mile.
Mm-hmm.
I liked the script, and I called him, and I said, Tom, could you help me out here a little bit? I'd like to read for the Green Mile. There's a prison guard in there who sees a mouse. I said, it's a small role, but I'd like to get out on it. He said, Holmes, I don't really get involved with other directors' choices. It's an uncomfortable situation to be involved in their process. They may have somebody they know you know, it's just he said, if it's my project, yeah, of course, I'd be happy to mention something, casting director. He said, but I just don't feel good about it. I said, I understand. I got you. Because he's the one who, if it hadn't been for him, I would have never been in Hollywood. Did you ever mention my name to Mr. Hanks? He was directing, but you didn't have time because he was busy directing then.
Well, no, basically we had the re-audition and that was my only interaction with him. I was fired 5 minutes later. You know, it was,
I thought you did the piece.
No, he
did not.
I never
hire
did
you.
It. No. And
well, now I think you should have mentioned it. Let's go back to that again.
It's a hard thing because when you're an actor, you know, you're desperate and that never helps. That's why I think ultimately that's why I think I was right to not mention Holmes's name to Tom Hanks is because I don't think in that moment it would have made me look more appealing. I think it would have been the equivalent of me getting up and doing a tap dance.
Yes, and Tom Hanks would have said,
I'd be like, wait, please hear me out. What about this? And I pull out a top hat again and I just start singing There's No Business Like Show Business.
You're actually more fired now.
Yeah, you have to leave.
Yeah, we'd like you to go. We were going to offer you a water on the way out, but now we'd just like you to go.
There's almost anything that I think of that involves a like, no, wait, how about this?
Yeah, it never, because everyone has psychically moved on.
Yeah. But I do think if I had a week, the thing that Holmes would have been able to say to Tom is that he acted opposite me for 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
And he would have been able to vouch for me that like, this is a good kid. He knows how to act, etc. It still might not have mattered.
Because yes, it might not have.
What I fundamentally don't know is, and I don't know that I can know this without knowing it from Tom Hanks.
Which is who you want an answer from, right? Or who you'd like, that sounds a little hard. It's like you would like to hear.
I'd love to talk to him about it.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I'd love to talk to him about anything. I got to say, it's not out of the realm of possibility in my job that I'd be at like a junket or something and talk to Tom Hanks. I would.
Don't do that, Jackie. I don't want to put other people at
risk.
No,
that seems fun.
I appreciate that, but don't be a hero, Jackie.
Okay.
I don't want you to like.
I think I'll do it.
I mean, it'd be great, but also it would steal our thunder a little bit because we kind of want that moment to happen on the podcast.
I would scoop you.
It would be amazing if I was just watching Sci-Fi Network and I was like, oh, I got my answer, but it was on like.
Yeah, but you didn't get it.
You wouldn't
have the satisfaction.
It's a small world, and a strange one. Think about it. I made up a character named Rian Johnson, who was an irrationally angry, toxic Star Wars fan. Decades later, there is a tiny but loud online cult of toxic Star Wars fans who are irrationally angry at a filmmaker named Rian Johnson, just because he wrote and directed a Star Wars film. Creating this character led me to write a screenplay for a film in which I ended up acting opposite Holmes Osborne, a man whose big break in the movies was given to him by Tom Hanks. Tom Hanks taught Holmes how to do less on the set of That Thing You Do. And a few years later, I borrowed that same lesson in film acting directly from Holmes by watching him underplay a scene and taking my cue from him to do the same. He learned it from Hanks, I learned it from Holmes. We don't always see these connections at the time. Often we aren't even aware of them. Tom Hanks' son, Colin Hanks, was on the TV show Mad Men, which starred a guy I was in a play with back in high school. Holmes Osborne was in the movie Anchorman with Will Ferrell, who would later be my boss when he was executive producer of The Chris Gethard Show, which for a brief moment was on a cable network whose parent company was owned by Disney, who also owns Star Wars, and whose founder, Tom Hanks, once played in a movie. A man who was born in Missouri, just like me and Holmes, and who is forever associated with the phrase, "It's a small world after all." It certainly is. On the next episode of Dead Eyes, we are going to take a very stupid detour, but I am really excited about it.
Ha ha ha. I just walked in. What's up?
I won't be talking about Band of Brothers or Tom Hanks at all. Instead, I am going to try to solve a minor casting mystery, all in one episode.
I wore sneakers on the beach.
We're going to talk about a feature film that I auditioned for. I did not get the part, and when the movie eventually came out in theaters, the character I auditioned for had disappeared.
This is going to take me back to a very challenging time in my life.
What happened to that character? And why? And when? And how? It's a mystery, and I'm not saying I'm the only person who could solve it, but I believe I am the only person who actually would even try to. I'm talking about the mystery of Gary the Masturbator.
Dead Eyes is a production of HeadGum Studios. It was created by me, Connor Ratliff. It was also written by me, and it's mostly me that you hear talking, including now. The show is produced and edited by Harry Nelson and Mike Comite. Special thanks to my guests, Ryan Johnson, Jackie Jennings, and Holmes Osborne. If you like Dead Eyes, please do all the things that podcasts ask you to do. Subscribe, rate, review, follow us on Twitter at Dead Eyes Podcast, and talk about it nicely on social media. Please tell your friends about this show, especially if you are friends with Tom Hanks, whose debut feature film, That Thing You Do, is, I think, maybe one of the most purely enjoyable first films I've ever seen. He'd only directed a couple of things for television prior to that, and it's just astonishingly confident and fun, and the song is fun. It makes me wish he would write and direct more movies, because he's only done it twice, except it would mean less time for him to be available to act in other people's films, so I get why he doesn't. But if he ever does make another film, I am available to audition, and you can tell him I said that. We'll be back next week. Thanks for listening.
That was a HeadGum Original.